This is the Northeast Ohio AFSC Weekly Audio Podcast. I'm Greg Coleridge. It is Friday, October the 14th. Thanks so much for listening. We seek every week to inform you about issues you feel are important, update you about past and upcoming AFSC plans and activities, and inspire you to take action. It is, after all, grassroots social movements made up of well-informed, prepared, and motivated people that always create real change. We were involved with three activities this past week in some way. The major one was last weekend, both Saturday and Sunday, a two-day series of events around the theme of what the bleep happened to hip-hop. This was a combined effort between AFSC, Move to Amend, Cleveland, and a group called Hip-Hop Congress. Nationally, Move to Amend and Hip-Hop Congress have organized these gatherings that have looked at the corporatization of our culture in general and the hip-hop genre in particular, holding events like this, workshops and performances around the genre of hip-hop in probably seven or eight communities. Cleveland was just the latest. And it was just a terrific gathering, brought together individuals during the day of Saturday last week, that explored all the different venues of hip-hop, what it was, the growth of it, how it was captured or commercialized, corporatized, the international growth and development, what people are doing to keep the social messaging going, and what they're doing to try to wrestle back hip-hop from the various corporations that have used the genre to enrich themselves and, of course, to debase the culture by lifting up themes of violence, misogyny, and other extremely unhealthy and horrific values and concerns. There were workshops around the criminal justice system, since there has been a glorification of some hip-hop artists to go to prison first. That sort of increases their street cred, so to speak. But in looking at the criminal justice system, the workshop also examined the prison industrial complex and what that means and the privatization of prisons and the impact that has had on our communities, particularly urban areas. There was a workshop on voter education that I facilitated. So it was a really fine piece. And, of course, a session on where we go from here. All that took place during the day on Saturday. Saturday evening, then, was a performance, artist showcase, probably 15 or so Cleveland area, a couple from outside Cleveland as well in Northeast Ohio, performed, giving a sampling of their socially conscientious and message-oriented hip-hop artistic performances. And it was just great. That program went about, geez, a couple of hours long. It was a full day indeed. All told, the takeaway from it, from that day, and the follow-up on Sunday, where there was a session on where do we go from here, how do we plan, together and separately, was the commitment to form a hip-hop Congress chapter in Cleveland, as well as work together as organizations with Move to Amend and AFSC to promote, and particularly to try to touch the lives of young people and to reach out and convey the messaging and to try to get people more politically engaged. So looking forward to that ongoing relationship with these other organizations in use of hip-hop as a pop cultural means of conveying information and to mobilize people to bring about change in their communities and beyond. So that was last weekend, Saturday and Sunday in Cleveland. This past week, I also gave a talk at the University of Akron on social change in AFSC in a social work class, and that was on Tuesday, and on Wednesday was the latest meeting of Radio Free Akron, the low-power FM radio station that is Probably now within a couple of weeks. In fact, for sure, we will be streaming online. Radio Free Akron, you can go to the website, radiofreeakron.org, find out details of when that will happen. But WMVU will be, which stands for We Are Many Voices United, will be streaming online. And we hope not too long thereafter, we'll be up and running on the air. Which will be 96.9 on the FM dial in the city of Akron. We are planning a fundraiser that will take place in the middle of November. More details on that in the next couple of weeks. Well, that was last week. Coming up this week are a few events that are worthy of sharing that we'll be involved in. AFSC is a co-sponsor tomorrow, Saturday, October 15th, in what's being called the Holy Day of Atonement event. It's being sponsored by the official Lorain County Organizing Committee for the Holy Day of Atonement, taking place in Lorain at God's Kingdom Church, 1671 North Ridge Road in Lorain. It will be commemorating the life of Muhammad Ali, and focusing on the themes of reconciliation and responsibility. And the family and supporters of Muhammad Ali, recently passed, have set up a worldwide campaign to try to get individuals to be dedicated to service and working for justice and nonviolent social change. So that will be the theme of this Ali 75 initiative, calling on all concerned citizens to commit to 75 hours of community service over the next year. I will be speaking at that event. It begins at 1 o'clock at, again, God's Kingdom Church, 1671 North Ridge Road in Lorain. AFSC committee person, Imam Paul Hassan, is the main energy behind that event. He always pulls off just a terrific event to commemorate this anniversary. The Holy Day of Atonement is an anniversary of the Million Man March that took place in 1995 in Washington, D.C., that brought together upwards of a million people to focus on positive social change in the African American community. So that is tomorrow, Saturday, October 15th, beginning at 1 p.m., Lorain, Ohio. God's Kingdom, 1671 North Ridge Road. On Tuesday, I will be speaking on the topic of legalized democracy at the Crossroads Branch Library in Cambridge, Ohio. The address there is 63500 Byesville, that's B-Y-E-S-V-I-L-L-E, Byesville Road in Cambridge, in trying to bring together individuals in the greater Cambridge area who are interested in pursuing a move to amend campaign, whether that takes the form specifically of a resolution and or a ballot initiative to try to promote the whole theme of how we don't have a democracy and why don't we, the people, have the right to decide basic political and economic conditions, how have corporations acquired so much power to basically do virtually what they want, when they want, wherever they want, and what can individuals do to assert or reassert, depending on how you want to look at things, real self-determination, democracy, sovereignty, whatever you want to call it. People down in that part of the state, Southeast Ohio, have been dealing with for many years the power and influence of oil and gas drilling corporations that have usurped the power of local communities, their right to decide to keep out such businesses, and have gone to the state to overturn democratically enacted powers and rules at the municipal level through zoning boards to keep out polluting and dangerous and expensive and road-destroying and environmentally destructive practices that many communities have not wanted but have been forced upon them. That's what corporate influence has done. That's one example, and communities and individuals there have fought just with tremendous amount of persistence and consistency to do that. Nevertheless, this is being done to them against their will. So there will be no doubt a number of people who have been part of that struggle who will be coming and wanting to explore this whole theme of right to decide, and certainly a complementary strategy that people in Ohio and around the country have been using has been this whole community rights approach that the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund, CELDEF, nationally has promoted and has been successful in trying to get communities to pass ordinances and laws to prevent, to assert the rights of people over the rights of corporations, as well as the rights of nature over the rights of corporations. So I'm sure that whole strategy will be explored at this meeting as well. That is going to begin at 6 p.m. at Crossroads Branch Library, 63500 Bisville Road in Cambridge. If anyone knows of anyone in Cambridge, let them know. This is an event taking place. It is free, open to the public, sponsored by a couple of individuals who have been active in that part of the state fighting against the oil and gas industry. So we'll be exploring how citizen power and rights can be asserted over the rights of power, the powers of the super rich, and of corporations. Also taking place on Tuesday, that is October the 18th, will be a gathering of individuals connected to the People's Justice and Peace Committee, who helped organize last July's People's Justice and Peace Convention in Cleveland, which adopted a People's Justice and Peace platform, which lifted up five core practices and a number of specific policy planks around various themes under the heading of justice, environmental justice, social and racial justice, environmental justice, economic justice, and political justice. These platforms were presented to both the Republican and Democratic National Conventions and will be shared, at least in summary form, this Tuesday evening in Cleveland at a gathering at Case Western Reserve University from 6:30 to 8 at the Ford Auditorium, which is in the Allen Memorial Medical Library. Address is 11000 Euclid Avenue in Cleveland. And at that time, representatives from the People's Justice and Peace Convention will be sharing the results of the convention, and in particular lifting up the People's Platform, but most importantly to use it as an introduction and as a dialogue to involve particularly new voters or voters who may be completely mystified at what has been taking place, at least as publicly reported in the corporate press, a dearth of issues being discussed, but rather personalities and smears going right and left, up and down throughout the corporate press. So this event is an attempt to lift up issues that we feel are important to be addressed, that aren't being addressed or are not being addressed adequately by both political parties, that was developed at this People's Platform. So again, during the convention back in July. So again, this program is open to the public, Tuesday, October 18, 6:30 at Case Western Reserve, Ford Auditorium, located in the Allen Memorial Medical Library, 11000 Euclid Avenue, AFSC, along with many of the organizations that were part of planning the convention, will be in attendance. So join us. Lastly, next Wednesday will be the monthly conference call open to all of the Move to Amend Ohio network. Very important call on Wednesday the 19th, beginning at 7 o'clock, where what will be shared is the 2017 proposed goals of the Move to Amend Ohio network. Seven of them in particular that was established by the coordinating committee will be presented, explained, and discussed for 1 hour, and input is needed by everyone who is interested in promoting Move to Amend here in Ohio. Details of the call are this. You can call 215-241-7110 or toll free 866-318-6943. The access code is 3667-8871. Again, the phone 215-241-7110 or toll free 866-318-6943 with the access code being 3667-8871. For details about what the proposed goals are, you can go to the Move to Amend. I think we posted them on the Move to Amend. Not sure now. I think we posted them on the Facebook page, so check that out there. If they aren't, as soon as I'm done taping this, I will add it to the Facebook page of Move to Amend Ohio. Join us on that call at that time, Wednesday at 7 p.m. Turning now to a couple of news items from this past week worthy of some brief comments. The first, and there's three for this week. The first is an article that appeared in, of all places, a place called Money Morning that was written by David Zeiler, and the title of the article was How Corporations Turn $1 of Political Spending into a $760 windfall at your expense. And it basically talks about who gets the most corporate, you know, who gets the most welfare in this country, and the article says it's corporations. And among those who get the most corporate welfare, i.e. government, you know, freebies to for-profit companies, it basically comes down to those corporations that give or invest the most political spending on campaign donations as well as lobbying in Washington. And it turns out that those companies spending the biggest bucks, you know, they're getting the biggest rewards, and all of that is coming at the expense of us taxpayers. They, in this article, point to, and we've mentioned this study before, but given its shocking conclusions, is definitely worth repeating. They reference a 2014 report called Fixed Fortune, produced by the Sunlight Foundation, a nonpartisan nonprofit, that looked at political spending from 2007 to 2012. And it looked at lobbying expenditures and campaign contributions or donations of the 200 companies most politically active in the U.S. And in particular, they tried to determine what not only they gave, but what they got in return. And basically what it showed is just among these 200 corporations over that period, 2007 to 2012, $5.8 billion over the 6 years is what these companies invested via campaign contributions and lobbying. What they got in return, $4.4 trillion in corporate welfare. Put another way, for every $1 that they invested, they got $760 back. Over the 6 year period, these 200 companies won a third of all the money that was doled out, which was $3 billion worth of government contracts. And they got 73% of the $410 billion distributed under the Troubled Asset Relief Program, or TARP. The largest recipients, they're all household names, Microsoft, Verizon, McDonald's, United Parcel, Walmart, and others, you know, iconic names. But those receiving the most corporate welfare of the 200, some received upwards of over 100,000%. The average return on investment, according to the Sunlight Report Foundation report, of these 200 companies was 76,000% in return. Some of the names, General Motors, they received 107,000% return on their investment of $65 million. They got back $70 billion. Military contractors, Lockheed Martin, got over $204 billion in benefits from the government after having invested $92 million. And it should be said that that $92 million, where did that come from? They being a military contractor, for the most part, they are solely on the government dole. They have very little public business or private business. Most of the money they receive comes from us through weapons contracts. So most of the money that they're investing at the front end in lobbying and political contributions are our tax dollars to begin with. And then they're receiving back this incredible amount of money that is a return of, they invested $92.7 million, got back $204 billion. That's 220,000%. And then there's the big banks. Goldman Sachs got 603,000% return. J.P. Morgan Chase, 909,000% return on their investment. Citi Group, 1.1 million percent return on their investment. And it's not only U.S., but also foreign banks. Credit Suisse, USB Bank. The most galling, though, of all may be Deutsche Bank, which, if you read the news right now, is teetering on the edge of collapse because of their risky speculative investments that go back to preceding the 2007 through 9 financial implosion, which was due to such speculative investments that they're still doing. And the amount of derivatives that they own is in the hundreds of trillions of dollars. Anyway, through and during this period of time, 2007 through 2012, their return on investment was 3.3 million percent. Back based on what they gave. Their tax dollars, our tax dollars at work, it describes perfectly the current instance of how Washington works, which is pay to play. If you pay, then you can play and get back an enormous amount of money, particularly if you are a very large company and the very cream of the cream, the top of the pile. These 200 companies have just been profiting enormously. And it just shows when you have the power and the right, constitutional right, to give, to donate, to invest, as corporations do and wealthy individuals do, it is no wonder that public policy is going to be skewed and skewed horrifically toward them and against us, we the people, taxpayers. Well, a second piece. This week, nearly a third of Ohio's charter sponsors of schools face revocation is the title of a couple of articles that appeared over the past couple of days in various newspapers talking about the charter school debacle that exists in Ohio. The state of Ohio, that nearly a third of Ohio charter school sponsors could have their authority revoked under new evaluations of how well these sponsors are following current educational rules and laws. The 21 sponsors that received a poor rating from the Ohio Department of Education just yesterday can appeal, but the poor rating doesn't affect individual schools whose sponsorship, if their charters are revoked of these private entities, would simply switch to the state if a new sponsor can't be found. The state also rated 30 sponsors beyond the 21 that received such a poor rating. 39 others received an ineffective rating, meaning they can't sponsor new schools and will have to create an improvement plan. Only 5 sponsors of charter schools were rated as effective. There's a couple of comments worth sharing, I think, from this piece. One is, you know, the very first point made in both of these articles talked about having their authority revoked. Well, what does exactly that mean? What it means is that charter schools, like any corporation, to exist in the state of Ohio, they have to have a license. Similar to any professional person who wants to practice in Ohio, doctor, lawyer, psychologist, just can't practice. They have to meet certain conditions. And to do that, the state requires that they have certain qualifications, academic, certain experience, certain other things that they follow the law and the like. And if they do, then they can get a license. Well, the equivalent for a corporation is a charter. To operate in the state, they have to have a charter. That charter gives them the authority to operate according to certain rules that the state establishes. Well, charters now are trying to have it both ways, as many corporations try to have it both ways. But in the case of charters, they want public tax dollars to educate students, but don't want the same standards of accountability of public schools. It's the same story of all privatized services, where these companies that have privatized a public service, they want all the benefits, but none of the costs, meaning none of the responsibilities. They try to externalize those. They try to privatize or corporatize the gains, but socialize the pains. Here, in the case of these charter schools, what the state is saying is that these 21 schools that have sponsors that have received a poor rating, meaning they have done a poor job of overseeing that the students receive basic minimal standards of education as established by the state school board. And because they've received such a poor rating, their charter may be revoked, meaning their authority will be revoked. Charters or licenses are, and were meant to be, early on democratic tools, much more powerful than merely fines or other slaps on the wrist. The state, in the past, when corporations were not adhering to the rigid requirements set by we the people and those we elect, as a democratic tool to keep corporations beholden and subordinate to we the people, when those requirements as established in the charter were not followed, their charters were revoked. But of course, over time, corporations worked to whittle down either charters themselves or to put language in them that was so vague that literally any behavior can be done and a corporation would still be in compliance. So it's been very weakened, such charter authority and what it is required minimally to get a charter. But nevertheless, despite its weakness, its more difficulty to impose charter revocation, and with the laws being far less potent than they were, nevertheless, charters are an affirmation that corporations don't have unlimited freedoms, that they are bound to rules established by we the people and those we elect, who establish regulations, and they still need to be followed. And if they aren't, then we the people, through our elected officials, should not fear at all to exercise them. And to do so is something that has a very long history in our state that goes back to the founding of our state, where charters were routinely revoked by state legislators, by courts, against corporations that were acting in violation of their charter, either not doing what is minimally required or doing things that were not at all listed, acting beyond their authority, what the Latin term is ultra vires, beyond their authority. And by doing so, in either case, either not following the minimal rules established in the charter or acting beyond the rules and stipulations established in the charter, their charters can be revoked and were revoked. That is still on the books, is still a power that state legislators should not at all be fearful of or should shy away from. This is a potent tool, not as potent as it once was, but still can be done, both to get rid of law-breaking corporations as well as to serve as a deterrent. That if you do not follow the basic rules governing what is established in your charter or license, then your charter will be revoked and your ability to do business as you want to will no longer take place. Nevertheless, charter revocations are still no substitute for ensuring that corporations don't have, to begin with, inalienable constitutional rights and that money is not speech. While charter revocations is a power that state lawmakers can impose, getting rid of corporate personhood and money as speech is something that only federal public officials can initiate through passing a constitutional amendment that then would be and would need to be ratified at the state level. There is a second way to do that that we've mentioned before, that states can initiate a call for a constitutional convention, that if such a convention would be called, then one of the things they could do is to end this bizarre twin notion that corporations are persons and money is speech. But nevertheless, that's not something that Move to Amend or others are calling for. We want to pursue the constitutional amendment proposal at the federal level first, and hopefully that will be the route that can be taken. Well, finally, a news piece you may have seen, read, heard about this past week, that the Public Utilities Commission of Ohio gave FirstEnergy up to $200 million in surcharges each year for the next 3 years, with a chance to extend and expand the increases for an additional 2 years. This came via objections by consumer groups, environmentalists, business customers. The increase is of $132 million annually, plus what's being called a gross-up to pay the company's federal taxes on the new money. That will be hidden on the delivery side of customer bills, meaning even customers who buy power from competitors will have to pay for it. This amounts to an increase of about $3 a month for the average utility user, or $36 a year. It's considerably less than the cost of what FirstEnergy wanted beginning a couple of years ago. They had wanted upwards of $558 million or $1.1 billion annually, somewhere within that range, which would have included bailing out the dirty and antiquated power plants, David Bessie Nuclear Plant in Toledo, and the Samus Coal Fire Plant along the Ohio River. Now, the money is supposed to be for what's called distribution modernization. That is to upgrade the company's local electricity delivery system, meaning it's supposed to go to improve and upgrade the wiring that FirstEnergy uses to transmit electricity throughout its service area. That's what it's supposed to go for. However, the Public Utilities Commission of Ohio didn't specifically order the company to use the new money for that specific purpose, to make improvements to its wiring. Buried in the ruling, apparently, it states that the purpose of the increase is predominantly to help the company avoid a credit rating downgrade that would limit its ability to borrow to make any upgrades. So sort of making the upgrades is secondary to making sure that the company doesn't financially tank. A recent analysis, apparently by a Wall Street firm, argued that the company faces large pension payments in the future, as well as deferred executive compensation charges to retiring, you know, CEOs and the like, who would be getting millions of dollars in golden parachutes and other incredibly enriching packages when they retire or leave the company. Businesses and families will again be required to pay more for the same service they already receive. Those who were against this plan and decision by PUCO assert, with only a hope that customers will gain an upgraded grid if and when the utility elects to do so, if they decide to do so at all. The decision is being appealed by a number of groups, including the Ohio Environmental Council, Sierra Club, and the Ohio Manufacturers Association. Well, a couple of takeaways from this. One is we need to understand what FirstEnergy Corporation actually is. You know, it's a private company that has had until recent times a monopoly on the provision of electricity in its market. Like other utility corporations across the country, in a similar situation, they resisted both public ownership and regulation and oversight and competition from others. So they have resisted, as a lot of these private companies who have monopolies in a certain geographic market have, up until, you know, a decade or so ago. There were double threats, one being that there should be greater public oversight or regulation, and then the second threat is there should be competition from others outside the market. These entities that have had a foothold in a single geographic area have resisted both. They only came around to supporting competition if and only if they received public subsidies to bail out uncompetitive plants, like in the case of First Energy, the uncompetitive and antiquated, dirty coal-fired power plants and nuclear plants that just basically couldn't exist without subsidies from the state, federal government, and the like. So unless they receive such public subsidies, then forget it. They're against private competition from others. Time was when most utilities of all kinds were totally publicly owned. Streetcar lines, electricity, water, sewer, railroads. Since monopolies and the corporate drive for profits don't go well together. You know, to have a monopoly and to still have a private company operating a monopoly, you know, those two things don't really exist very well. And that is why utilities of all kinds, beginning first with railroads, the emphasis was they should be a public utility. And there were calls by the populace over 100 years ago to have them be publicly owned. Same with streetcar lines, which in many cases were publicly owned by municipalities or equivalent municipal entities, electricity systems, water systems, sewer systems. Cleveland still has its own municipally owned electricity system, Cleveland Public Power. There were dozens, scores of communities that had such publicly owned systems that only were changed in the creation of these things called regulatory agencies with the blessing of corporations, because the alternative, of course, was public ownership. So rather than being publicly owned and taken over, beginning first with the railroad corporations and others, they came around to this alternative sort of third way, which is rather than straight total competition or public ownership, let's have this quasi-system where you have these regulatory agencies, but we as private entities still remain public or private entities and can benefit from the profits, but having some sort of minimal regulations. And that's what these entities like the Public Utility Ownership or Corporation of Ohio, PUCO, were. They became captured. They became sort of a shield to the private entities. The alternative to past widespread public control of public utilities were these entities like PUCO. Over time, the solution wasn't to remunicipalize public utilities, but to open up the market to competition from other corporate behemoths. And that's what happened beginning a decade or so ago. While better in some respects, in other respects, it's worse, because now the public has even less influence over basic decision-making concerning services, management, etc. This isn't an improvement either economically or politically, and once more is a reason for us to raise up the question of what it really means in our modern society, in modern times, to have the right to decide. What does that mean? What does right to decide actually entail? And in this case, it seems as if the public has even less power and authority to decide what these public utilities are doing than ever before. That's a problem, and why we should be raising the issue and asking the question and grappling with how we can have a democracy that is not just symbolic, but real, but actual, where we have decisions over what takes place in our political realms, but also increasingly what is taking place in our economic realm. Well, that's all for this week. Keep up with our activities. Contact us with questions, concerns, or willingness to help out. Our phone number is 330-928-2301. Website, afsc.org/Akron. Facebook page, facebook.com/NEOAFSC. Program blog, northeastohioafsc.wordpress.com. My blog, createrealdemocracy.wordpress.com. Until next week onward, for justice, peace, and democracy.